Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed in Radio DMG may or may not be the views and opinions of the DMGI's family of sites. All music used in this podcast is the property of whoever made it, and no copyright infringement is intended. God bless this albatross, and hold on tight for the awesome you're about to receive.
It's good to be the king.
Welcome to Radio DMG. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and today is September 2nd, 2011. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're not going to have newsity because there is so much of it, and so vast amounts of it, that I'm going to go ahead and put it in a separate podcast. I'm sorry, we're just going to do an all newsity podcast right after this, because there's the Dragon Warrior Conference coming up. Sorry, Dragon Quest Conference coming up in Japan. There's Gamescom over there. Is it not Gamescom? Wait, it's a Tokyo Game Show. There's that. There's a bunch of stuff coming up. We also have Non-Descon coming up, and then I'll be explaining a few things about animation as art and the two new shows for Radio DMG. So there is a lot to go over, and because I want to devote a lot of this time in this episode to Peter S. Beagle and his work of art, The Last Unicorn. The Last Unicorn was a book written by Peter S. Beagle. I don't have the time that he wrote it right in front of me in my notes, sorry. But it was made into a movie, an animated movie, in about 1982. It came out, and it is amazing. You should go check out the book or the movie if you haven't already. They're available on DVD and Blu-ray. I suggest that before you listen on, you should make yourself familiar with the work of Peter S. Beagle. In fact, to make you just slightly familiar with it, I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit from the first chapter in The Last Unicorn. I'm just going to read a little bit of the, just so you get a flavor of this type of writing. It's really good, actually. Here. The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle, Chapter 1. The unicorn lived in a lilac wood, and she lived alone. She was very old, though she did not know it, and she was no longer the careless color of seafoam, but rather the color of snow, falling on a moonlit night. But her eyes were still clear and unwearied, and she still moved like a shadow on the sea. She did not look anything like a horned horse, as unicorns are often pictured, being smaller and cloven-hoofed, and possessing that oldest, wildest grace that horses have never had. The deer have only in a shy, thin limitation, and goats in a dancing mockery. Her neck was long and slender, making her head seem smaller than it was, and the mane that fell almost to the middle of her back was as soft as dandelion fluff, and as fine as cirrus. She had pointed ears and thin legs, with feathers of white hair at the ankles, and the long horn above her eyes shone and shivered with its own seashell light even in the deepest midnight. She had killed dragons with it, and healed a king whose poisoned wound would not close, and knocked down ripe chestnuts for bear cubs. Unicorns are immortal. It is their nature to live alone in one place, usually a forest where there is a pool clear through enough for them to see themselves, for they are a little vain, knowing themselves to be the most beautiful creatures in all the world, and magic besides. They mate very rarely, and no place is most enchanted than one where a unicorn has been born. The last time she had seen another unicorn, the young virgins who still came seeking her now... Oh, so, whoops, my bad. Wait, the last time she'd seen... I can't read. Well, I can't read out loud, but you kind of get the idea. I suggest that you check it out, and you definitely should read his work. It's available online. There's even an audiobook that's narrated by Peter S. Beagle himself, and I think you should check it out. Now, I'm going to play a little bit of audio from the movie. I'm going to play the trailer and two of the songs from the movie, because since we're nonprofit, we can get away with that. Woo! But yeah, and then we're going to be right back over here, and I'll introduce the interview. So, strap those headphones on, people, and hold on tight for the audio that you're about to receive.
She is a creature of legend. In an age of sorcery and savagery.
Well, what have we here?
Demons.
No!
And dragons. She may be the last unicorn.
All I want to know is if you've seen other unicorns like me somewhere in the world.
You can find the others if you are brave. They passed down all the roads long ago, and the Red Bull ran close behind them and covered their footprints.
Oh, I could never leave this forest. But I must know if I am the only unicorn left in the world.
The classic tale is now a classic animated adventure. Featuring the voices of Mia Farrow.
The spell was wrong, but there was true magic in it.
Alan Arkin.
My dear, you deserve the services of a great wizard, but I'm afraid you'll have to be glad of the aid of a second-rate pickpocket.
Jeff Bridges.
That is exactly what heroes are for.
It's you or me, Moth. Hand to hand to hand to hand.
Robert Klein. Christopher Lee.
I am King Haggard.
And the music of America.
It's the last unicorn.
A journey into the unknown.
Go on!
A mystery full of wonders and a fantasy beyond imagining.
Not that one.
I want to know who she is.
Schmendrick the Light.
Do as you will!
Look and see her, how she sparkles.
The last unicorn. The legend will live forever.
This is Peter S. Beagle, and you are listening to Radio DMG.
Mountain and the last
when the last moon is cast over the last star of morning, and the future has passed without even a last desperate warning, then look into the sky where through the clouds a path is torn. Look and see her, how she sparkles. It's the last unicorn.
And we're back. Well, I'm back. Okay, I have to admit, I really, really love the music in The Last Unicorn. And while it does make this particular episode seem kind of melancholy, in fact, this episode is called Into the Woods with Peter S. Beagle. That's the name we decided to give it. The Into the Woods part is actually a reference to Sondheim. Anyway, Stephen Sondheim. Anyways, I probably would explain that in more detail, but I intend to do a Keeping the Bridge. Oh, by the way, Keeping the Bridge is all sorts of history and explanations on books and things. So if you're a person who likes to learn, you're going to love that one. But we'll explain it in a later episode, and it's going to be awesome. But for right now, I'm going to go ahead and do another bit of music. That last bit of music was the theme to the movie The Last Unicorn by America. And this one here, this next upcoming one, I thought was kind of interesting because it's Jeff Bridges singing. Yeah, that Jeff Bridges from like True Grit or The Big Lebowski or so many other things. The dude sings. Anyways, I thought you might enjoy it, and then we'll be back with the interview. So stay right there. You're listening to Radio DMG. I'm Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and we're going to cue the music. Been a while since I said that.
I've had time to write a book about the way you act and look, but I haven't got a paragraph. Words are always getting anyway, I love you. That's all I have to tell you. That's all I've got to say. And now I'd like to make a speech about the love that touches you. Stumbling, I would make you laugh. I feel as though my tongue were made of clay. Anyway, I love you. That's all I have to tell you. I'm not a man of poetry. Isn't one with me, it runs from me, it runs from me, and I tried to write a symphony, but I lost the melody. Alas, I only finished half, and finish I suppose I never made. I love you.
Our heart obeys.
That's all I have to tell you.
Now that I'm a woman,
that's all I've got to say.
Now I know the way.
I've got to say.
Now I know the way.
That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, I like the music in this movie a lot. Like I said, I recommend people go out and buy the Blu-ray, because actually the Blu-ray is not censored. There's a little bit of audio that was censored in the previous DVD release. There's a part where one of the characters says "damn," and it's important though because it drives part of that character's emotion. Now, The Last Unicorn is not really a happy story. It's a story full of a lot of trials and tribulations and heartbreak. Things don't turn out the way they were planned. Part of the reason, actually, why I called this episode Into the Woods with Peter S. Beagle is because I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about the play Into the Woods, or rather the book of psychology that it's based on. We'll do that at a different time, probably in Keeping the Bridge. We'll examine that piece of artwork and explain about it and give a bit of background on it, because a lot of what Keeping the Bridge will be doing is educational. Because I believe that if we don't study our art, our culture, our books, if we don't make those available or look at them, if we don't read them, we'll forget them. And when we forget them, the worst part about forgetting the past is you don't know or remember what you lost. You don't know you're missing it. And you go through life not knowing you're missing it. In fact, one of the themes in The Last Unicorn, actually, is the nature and feeling of regret. The story, the main character in it, despite being rather old, the unicorn, the main character of this, is supposedly wise beyond her years or so, but in a way, kind of naive when she first starts out. It's kind of funny because it's really an opposite of an Into the Woods type story. In Sondheim's Into the Woods, the characters go into the woods to find different items to help them through their various stories, and they discover that going into these woods, which are kind of a metaphor for growing up or going out into the world, they find that what they were looking for wasn't really what they got. And things didn't turn out the way they planned it. And you can't have, everything's not perfect. The whole point of it is that it's not perfect. Now, in the woods where the unicorn lives at the beginning of the story, everything is perfect, but she actually leaves those woods. And by that way, by growing away from that, discovers feelings and regret and sorrow. Part of the whole point of the book is that we are made whole by our experiences. We may not know them, but the experience of pain, of sadness, of sorrow and regret are very important to our development. They make us better people, or unicorns, or magicians, or kings, or princes, or princesses, and such. They make us better people. That sorrow. That's reading a bit into it, and, I believe that all art can be interpreted regardless of the intent of the author. In fact, there's actually a question about that in the interview, which I think was pretty well addressed. So, without further ado, and without further, without further music, let me go ahead and start up our feature presentation, our interview with Peter S. Beagle from Akon 22 in 2011.
And welcome back to Radio DMG. I am your host, Philip Wesley, and with me in the studio today are
Peter S. Beagle
and Connor Cochran.
Peter S. Beagle is the author of The Last Unicorn and various other works of fantasy, fiction, and hopefully probably fiction.
Generally fiction.
Generally
with,
fiction.
With some nonfiction moments, essays, and...
Actually, Peter's a poet, a songwriter, a fantasy writer, a nonfiction writer, a screen and television writer, pretty much the whole gamut.
There is that.
A Renaissance man.
Well, no, I know people I think of as Renaissance people, but considering that I've been doing this for over 50 years, one way and another, that I raised children doing it, okay, you know, I'm impressed. Good for me.
I think it takes a true Renaissance to have raised children while doing this.
Well, I was a 24-year-old sudden father with three children, and there's a line of Samuel Johnson's that I'm always quoting such moments. Depend upon it, sir, when a man knows that he is to be hanged within a week, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. I had to start thinking. Working.
And working has set you about publishing how many novels and novelettes?
Well, actually, the scorecard has gotten a lot bigger in the last decade.
It has that.
Mm-hmm.
Peter's most famous novels are A Fine and Private Place and The Last Unicorn, but he also has novels like The Folk of the Air, The Innkeeper's Song, Tamsin, and upcoming, two new novels, I'm Afraid You've Got Dragons and Summer Long. Working with me in the last 10 years, I kind of kicked him in the butt and said, you should write more short fiction. People need to know you really exist still. And although he wasn't really known for his short fiction, between his first story that he sold when he was 17 and 1996, he only actually published about four pieces of short fiction, maybe five. And then in the late 90s, he published another six or seven. But since we started working together in 2002, he has actually written over 70 pieces of short fiction, short stories, novelettes, novellas.
Mind you, during that time, thanks to Mr. Cochran, to whom I'm eternally grateful, I have amassed a total of roughly 7 hours and 25 minutes of sleep.
Ooh, wow.
Well, that was only because you took 2003 off.
True. True. Well, it's a restful year.
Absolutely. So, going into these, what set you forward starting on your first book? When did you get into your head to write this book?
Well, I always wanted to write. I can't remember not wanting to write once it was really clear that being a great jazz guitarist or playing first base for the New York Yankees, both out. So that left nothing to do but write. And as far as the first novel goes, nobody ever sees this, including the writer I was imitating, Robert Nathan. But my memory is that I loved a book of his called One More Spring, written before I was born. And I just wanted to write that, except he already had. So I tried to write something like that, and it happened that I was 19 years old and working at a summer camp as a music counselor. And after the children were put to bed in their various bunks, there's really nothing to do in the evenings. And I had an empty room I could work in, and my little portable typewriter for the birthday present, and lots of paper. So I just started writing. And as I say, to my mind, I was imitating Robert Nathan the best way I knew how. But I got about three chapters done that summer in that empty room in the camp. And when I went back to college, I kept on working, and I had a couple of very good writing teachers who were very helpful and very supportive, and a roommate who didn't mind, you know, if I was typing at 1 a.m. You can't really type quietly, even on a Hermes noiseless portable, but I gave it my best shot and really tried not to wake him. And by the end of that senior year, I had most of a first draft. And that, the rest of the summer, I worked in finishing the book. Hmm. And that would have been 1959.
And it's been a part of your life since.
Well, Robert Nathan warned me when I dedicated The Last Unicorn to him, this is going to be the book people know who don't know that you ever wrote anything else. But I find it, which is true, it's the way it's worked out. And he lived long enough to remind me that he called it. But A Fine and Private Place has always had its own cult. It was always my mother's favorite. It was what attracted Connor's attention when he was 14.
Uh, Peter had two books put in mass market paperback in 1969. One was A Fine and Private Place, and the other was The Last Unicorn. I read A Fine and Private Place first, was absolutely floored by it. I was 14 years old. I read The Last Unicorn about a month later and couldn't believe that the same writer had written two such very different but equally amazing books, and I've been a raging fan ever since.
There was a book in the middle, which has never been published. I didn't think of myself consciously as a fantasy writer then. I just wanted to write Fine and Private Place. Now I needed to do a mainstream novel, set, you know, in the hard and fast reality of our times. And I wrote, you know, a second novel about a young musician, not writer, wandering around in Paris, as I was doing then. And it's like the old joke about the curate's egg. It's very good in parts.
There's actually a fragment of it that's going to finally surface and be part of a book we're doing. It's kind of a romp through Peter's filing cabinet. A few years ago, Subterranean Press published a limited edition book called The Last Unicorn, The Lost Version, which was the first radically different, unfinished 85-page draft of The Last Unicorn, plus a new introduction and afterward. And we're taking that material and a lot of other stuff, the four chapters that were cut out of A Fine and Private Place by the publisher before the book was released, and many other little bits and pieces of material from the filing cabinets to explore Peter's creative process and history. And one of the things in there will be a couple of sections of that unpublished mainstream novel from 1962.
Mm. What was the name of that novel?
What the hell was it
called? He called it, it's a name we've stolen to use
later.
That's
it.
He called it The Mirror Kingdom. And we've since actually used that as a version of that, Mirror Kingdoms, as the title of a best of anthology that was published by Subterranean Press.
Hmm. Going through, like, A Fine and Private Place and The Last Unicorn, going through a lot of earlier works from other writers and such, like Robert Heinlein or Philip K. Dick or H.P. Lovecraft, you see kind of a little bit of a politics into some of those. Do you feel that there is any kind of worldview or politics in A Fine and Private Place or The Last Unicorn? Is there a message you are trying to convey?
Not consciously. There'll be moments when I'm making a point through a character, or a character's making a point through me. I'm dread allegory, symbolism. I always go back to Mark Twain's introduction, a few lines before Huckleberry Finn. Persons attempting to find a moral in this story will be banished. There's a couple of degrees, I can't remember the second one, but the third is persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot. No, I put it like this. Years and years back, I made the mistake of attending a seminar on my work. I've never had one of those before. It was very academic, rather drowsy-making. But a woman I liked and had known read a paper on my symbolism. And she was on a novel of mine called The Folk of the Air. There's an old, dumpy woman in there named Sia. Athanasia Sioras, Greek woman, who turns out to be an extremely ancient goddess. And she's called Sia for short, Athanasia. And, you know, my acquaintance pointed out that it was really clever of me to name such a person Athanasia, because apparently in Greek it means immortal beauty. And then I had to get up and say, Jane, I named her Athanasia because when I was in high school, I had a big crush on this Greek girl named Sia, Athanasia. Her father was named Athan, and hers was the feminized version. And it was the only name that came into my head when I was writing the book.
All symbolism purely accidental.
Entirely.
Accidental or occidental, right?
But definitely, you know, like the disclaimer people put at the very beginning of a book, any resemblance to
any characters, any people living,
right, is purely,
living
purely
dead or undead,
right, purely, or undead, purely yes. Coincidental. And nobody, at least of my acquaintance, bases a character entirely on one person. I don't do that. I'll borrow a bit here and a bit there. You have to start somewhere. You have to have a foothold. after the foothold, you're on your own.
Any suggestions for our listeners on getting into writing? Or
the sitting down is a very important part.
True.
I mostly tell young writers, all I know is about showing up for work and making sure that what you do regularly. You know, I point out it's a muscle like any other. The imagination is, and the technique is. You go to the gym on a certain basis. You don't have to work all day the way I try to, but you do need to have a certain period of each day that's yours. It's your equivalent of Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. That's the one where nobody bothers you, even if it's just for an hour or 2 hours. Those are yours. And even it's easy to sit there when the work's coming steadily and fluently. It's the really tricky part, the professional part, is sitting there when nothing's happening. Mm. And you still have to be there. I grew up with a family of artists. I had three uncles who were painters. And then we get to the cellist and the choreographer, the art critic and so on. And the phrase I've used quite a lot recently is one of my Uncle Moses, who used to say, if the muse is late, start without her. My uncles would get up, have breakfast like anybody else, and go to their studios the way other people went to their offices. And they'd by and large work all day, except for two of them who were twins and very competitive. There'd be that break in the middle of the day where they'd sneak over to each other's studios just to see what the other one was doing that day. But that's what I grew up with, the notion that you can do this, make a life out of this, if you don't fool around. If you don't indulge yourself. And it was, I remember I had a fine and private place. I was working chapter by chapter. I had more outline than I usually do. And I'd play a game with myself. If I had a problem coming up in the next chapter, I wouldn't allow myself to go to sleep until I'd figured it out. I like to sleep. I'm very fond of sleep. I'd figure it out.
And you've been losing sleep, though, for a lot for The Last Unicorn for quite some time. There was that... You did a really great announcement this year at ACON 22 about finally winning that legal battle that's been raging on for years.
Well, now, winning is perhaps not the right term, because there wasn't actually a court case or a judgment. What happened was, for 7.5 years, we have been engaged in attempting to get the English company that owns the movie, The Last Unicorn, to actually live up to the contract and pay Peter what he's due. Just to give you numbers, in the last 11 years in America alone, 2.5 million VHS tapes and DVDs were sold, and Peter received not penny one from any of them, except the ones we sold ourselves at conventions or on the website we set up to help Peter. That's a pretty extreme case of ignoring a contract. And they had all kinds of standard Hollywood reasons for doing so. There was a claim that they hadn't made any money, and we'd knock that down, and then they'd claim something else, and we'd knock that claim down, and we'd be back around in the loop to the first claim. The
claims contradicted each other constantly.
It was quite annoying. But finally, when we were just about to go to court, we were actually able to leapfrog over this particular company and go to their parent company, which is ITV. It's a very, very large European media conglomerate, about £2 billion a year in business. It's kind of like saying ABC or CBS or NBC here in the States. It's a huge channel.
Or Fox or The Guardian over there, that type of thing. Sky TV.
It's huge. They are actually the single largest source of original television programming in Europe. Big, big company. And we went straight to their new CEO with our legitimate complaint. And we're fortunate enough to run into people who actually cared about proper treatment of creatives. And they looked at the facts and came to the same conclusion that we came to. And it wasn't so much winning as finally getting the attention of people with the authority to say, yes, this contract should be paid attention to, as opposed to a kind of standard middle management in a creative company where they're just trying to save the company money and polish their own careers by doing so. These people deserve to be named. The CEO of ITV is Adam Crozier, and I have nothing but the greatest respect for Adam, because he's the person who specifically tasked a man named Andrew Garrard with bringing this to a healthy for all parties conclusion. Andrew is the group legal director and corporate secretary of ITV, and when we met him for the first time last fall in New York City for our first negotiation, he and Peter hit it off like gangbusters. It turns out that Andrew is actually a reader. In fact, he proudly let us know that he'd read The Lord of the Rings 15 times by the time he was 17 years old. And of course, since Peter wrote the screenplay for the first film version of The Lord of the Rings, they hit it off just immensely well. And in fact, of that 2.5 hour meeting, I'll tell you that about half of it was just the two of them talking favorite authors with each other. And so we've had months of discussion, we've come to terms, it's all settled up now. Peter's getting paid what he's owed, and we're actually doing more than that. We're putting good business together, working with ITV to see that The Last Unicorn is brought out in an even bigger, brighter fashion than it ever has been before. So I wouldn't say so much that we won as everybody won. Fans, yes. Peter, ITV, all across the board.
Now, with The Lord of the Rings, was this the live-action or the animated Ralph Bakshi one? Yeah, Ralph Bakshi.
I did. What's on the screen is mine and Tolkien's. I share the credit with another writer, but I was brought in after he'd produced a script that I only remember for its misspellings.
Ooh. What was it like working with Ralph Bakshi?
Bakshi is, in my estimation, a certain percentage of really talented man and fair-sized percentage of street thug.
I saw Heavy Traffic.
No, that's perfectly real. And the thing is, though, as opposed to Saul Zentz, who is comfortable, an old shoe, and scruffy, and you forget at your peril that he used to be a chess hustler in New York. Bakshi is what he is. He's out there, loud, vulgar, not to be trusted, but it's right there. Yeah. And I must say that he's always wanted to be a real painter. And when he found out that my uncles were Raphael Moses and Isaac Sawyer, he turned into a 9-year-old hoping to meet Michael Jordan. And the nicest I ever saw him was when I yielded to his genuine pleadings and brought him to my uncle Raphael's studio in New York. And I watched the two of them, Bakshi towering over my tiny uncle, turning over Raphael's new oils, studying them together, and chattering happily in Russian. Bakshi was born in the Crimea and raised in partly in Palestine then and partly in Brooklyn. But he kept his Russian. My uncles had gone out of their way, though they came to America at 14 or so, gone out of their way not to lose the language. And as I say, that was the nicest I ever saw Bakshi. For the rest, you'd learn not to trust the man with anything important. But compared to Saul Zentz, I'll take Bakshi.
What was it like adapting a work like J.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings to a screenplay?
And specifically an animation screenplay, yes. Because the thing I've learned is that animation wants to be animated. It wants to move, it hates to sit still, and it hates backstory. And The Lord of the Rings is all backstory. Really it is.
Yes.
With people explaining things to each other. And that is why The Lord of the Rings is probably still the longest animation film ever made. I'm not an expert, but I'm betting it. And I remember I'm staying up in my little room at Claridge's Hotel, 12, 1, 2 in the morning. God knows how many times I rewrote that script. And I remember telling Bakshi, I'm 3/4 of the way through the script. We haven't even touched the Riders of Rohan yet. And Bakshi just groaned. And I realized, oh my God, he forgot about the Riders of Rohan. I used to think that The Lord of the Rings, at least, has to be the only book Ralph's ever read straight through. By the end of my work there, I wasn't entirely sure he'd finished it. But I liked his wife very much, Liz, who's very calm and sane and knows exactly what she's married to. And I remember staying over at his house in Hancock Park in Los Angeles and meeting his children, who clearly adored their father. So what do I know about anything?
Well, You do know your work and the last Unicorn and a lot of your other books like A Finding Private Place, and you've had an increase in following over the years, especially with the re-release of the last Unicorn and such. Since you guys are going to be putting out merchandise soon, eventually, what type of merchandise would you like to see for the last Unicorn?
That's
good God.
Everything. Hard, yes.
That's, everything.
It's hard for me to think beyond lunchboxes.
No, it's something we've been looking into. You can go to Comic-Con or Dragon-Con or all these conventions and buy the strangest, most wonderful merchandise about the most obscure things, and yet you can't get anything based on The Last Unicorn.
So, not even My Little Last Unicorn.
Right.
Or perfume, yes.
Well, that's new.
That's new.
And the reason for this is because the nature of the tangle of rights that was created by the original film contract, because it really did mess up and divide things in ways which made it unwieldy and gave incomplete pieces to lots of folks. So we, for example, are able to do certain kinds of merchandising. Recently, we've done an agreement with Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab to do a line of perfumes, 28 cents, based on Last Unicorn. 14 of them are out, 7 more are about to come out, and they're quite wonderful. But they can't have the imagery from the film on them. They can't be marketed in connection with the film because of the way the rights prior to this settlement we're working on.
You could always write it in French.
No.
Le Final Unicorn.
You can call it The Last Unicorn. That's not what I'm talking about. You can't use the visual imagery. We wound up actually having Renee DeLiz, who did the graphic novel for IDW, the art for that, the pencils, do the pencils out of the label. But this is what I mean. You can't have a... We could go make a Last Unicorn figurine, but it couldn't look like the Last Unicorn in the movie. Meanwhile, ITV could go out and make those sorts of things, but they just didn't. People would come to us saying they wanted to make them, and we'd send them to the licensing department at ITV, and they'd just bounce off and get no response. Mm-hmm. In fact, in all the years they've had the property, the only merchandising they ever did with it was one lunchbox deal and one T-shirt deal with Hot Topic for about a year and a half, and some socks. I've seen some Last Unicorn socks that were generated in about a year back in 1999. But nothing else. Now, that's going to change. There's all kinds of wonderful things that fans like to have, and we're going to, one by one, start making certain they happen.
Mm-hmm. Going back to books for a bit, are there any modern authors that you read?
Mm-hmm. But not everybody knows them.
Hmm.
There is a writer, lives in Seattle, about my age, named Michael Gruber, G-R-U-B-E-R. I don't know what the hell to say about Gruber. As far as I can figure, his background is in marine biology. But I know he's worked in Washington, D.C. Each of his books is different from the other, the way I try to keep mine separate. And I've never met the man, but I'll grab anything of his off the shelves. It's hard to say whether he's a fantasy writer or, I don't know, he's unclassifiable. But I just find myself whopper-jawed, as Huck Finn would say. Damn, I'd never have thought of that. Who the hell, it's like, who the hell is this guy? So Gruber fascinates me. And I'm currently reading and being floored once again, but a historical novelist named Diana Norman, who was my email pen pal for some years and who died last winter.
Hmm.
And I've been collecting her work, which is hard to find in this country, and thinking all over again. Damn it. You know, Diana, did you really not know how good you were? Her husband said she never really did.
That happens with a lot of authors. It's kind of rare. In today's age, we have a lot of the internet and all those types of social mediums where people find authors a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. It used to be that people would just wallow in obscurity for the majority of their lives, which is why it's a good thing and a very fortunate thing that you are being recognized for your work and your contributions to literacy and to essentially culture.
A writer named Harry Bernstein, mm-hmm. who literally became famous at 96 died recently at 101. But he had written a memoir, which suddenly became made him famous at 96, but he'd written fiction. He was obsessed all his life with reading. And I happened to have read the memoir. I didn't know that it had made him famous. I was delighted to hear it. But as I say, he was 96. Again, luck has a lot to do with it. Patrick O'Brien, he's known for his novels about seagoing novels about the Napoleonic Wars. Mm. Patrick O'Brien had been around for quite a while when the New York Times editor of the New York Times Book Review happened to need something to read on a transatlantic flight, read one of O'Brien's novels, wrote a 2-page spread about his work in the Book Review, and all of a sudden, at a fairly advanced age, Patrick O'Brien was famous. Which reminds me always of the line of the pitcher, Lefty Gomez, who pitched for the Yankees in the 1930s. He said, if they ever give you a choice between being lucky and being good, take lucky.
That's always a pretty good advice.
I think I've been very lucky.
Mm-hmm. And you've had a pretty good publisher, too, to help you with some of this, because I originally bought one of the first when I saw The Last Unicorn on DVD. I bought that first one, I bought the first one that came out, and then when I heard that you weren't getting paid for it, well, as soon as I was able to buy one where you would get paid for it, I bought that one, because frankly, it's a great movie. It's one of those that I grew up with. During the 80s, I watched a lot of animation, and during the early 90s, lots of animation. Growing up in the 80s, mm-hmm. we'd watch animation on Saturdays. I liked a lot of the fantasy ones, like The Chronicles of Narnia, mm-hmm. or even some of the more bucolic books, like Anne of Green Gables and such, yes. the live-action stuff for yeah. that. But, Books are a big part of the fandom here at Akon and outside of this, like at Comic-Con and such. A lot of you've got a lot of brand new fans. Is there a message that you'd like to tell them about your books? Like, let's say, for example, this is the first time they've heard of you. They don't know much of your work. They may have heard about The Last Unicorn from their friends or so. Would you rather they start with A Fine and Private Place or with The Last Unicorn?
I don't really care.
I don't really care?
I know that the movie, for which mm-hmm. I'm very grateful, has led a lot of people to the book. So that's usually the one people discover first. If they're interested, they find other books of mine. The way, if I fall in love with a writer, I'll try to jump on everything they've ever written. And the only message I have is that I do try to not to repeat myself. Mm-hmm. I get very nervous if I think, damn it, I used that before. Where the hell did I use that? I know I have.
I can speak to that for a moment mm-hmm. because I'm the raging fanboy here. I've been a fan of Peter's work since I was 14, like I said before. I know lots of writers. Peter's now 72. I know lots of writers who are still writing well into their 70s and later, and some of them are writing really, really well, but they tend to be writing the thing they write. You know, it's the mystery novelist who's writing the 25th book about his or her famous character. And you buy that book because you love that character and that writer. And it's like buying chocolate ice cream again, because you just feel like having some more chocolate ice cream.
Robert Parker comes to mind.
But Peter, because of this almost pathological fixation on not repeating himself, you can sort of start anywhere. You can find whatever story or novel appeals to you and develop your relationship with that, and then go try something else. And you're the only thing that you can be guaranteed is that it's going to be incredibly well-written and that it's going to be deeply moving in some fashion. I know, again, lots of people can scare the hell out of me. Lots of people make me laugh. Peter's one of the very few authors who can make me feel 3 or 4 conflicting emotions all in the same sentence. And it's a real thrill as a reader to go through that kind of rich interplay of emotion. So my best advice to anybody is just start anywhere and keep reading and be ready for surprises, because you There is, for example, that Mirror Kingdoms collection. Jonathan Strahan selected 20 of Peter's best stories to put in what Peter called the Big Brick of Beagle, since it was such a thick book. And it's unlike most collections. You simply, if you were to take the name Beagle off and just put the stories out there and ask someone, they'd tell you the 20 stories written by at least 10 or 12 different authors, not by one man, because they're just so diverse. It's fun, though.
There's a French writer dead some years ago named Romain Gary, G-A-R-Y, whom I always loved reading. But part of my attraction to Gary was that he didn't hesitate to do something entirely different than the last time. If it bombed, well, it bombed. You try something else. But clearly he was keeping himself interested as well. And people like that are the ones who catch my attention. Again, like Michael Gruber, I don't know who the hell you are, but okay, I don't know anything about this book, can't make anything out of the jacket copy, but I'll read it.
There's a question that I do like to ask a lot of the people I interview, especially at conventions like this. Now, at these conventions, there's a lot of energy that goes around. A lot of these, a lot of these fans, they're very exuberant and outgoing.
Yes.
Very, very, I guess, positive. And so, out inside the convention, but outside of it, they tend to clam up and be very shy or withdrawn. A lot of them have actual trouble relating to people outside of conventions. Is there any advice you would give them to help them become more assertive, or to bring that energy they have at the conventions to their everyday life?
I grew up very shy. I was comfortable with a few close friends. We're still close after 65 years. And animals. I'm very good with animals. What I do, talking to total strangers who come up worshipfully, is something of a trick, but it's, or learned behavior, whatever you want to call it. But what I do know is that I learned to ask people about themselves, because people want to talk about themselves. And it's only in conventions that a lot of them get to do it. And I suppose my advice is simply to, partly it's just plain practice, talking to people who aren't, you know, of your particular persuasion, so to speak, people who have never read Tolkien, whatever. But I know it does take practice, but it's like the outreach program for bullied gay, lesbian, transgender people, transsexuals. It does get better. And having done this so often, there's a great deal I can do in my sleep. I try not to do it in my sleep.
Sometimes it's good to be awake, especially if you have to write.
But I mean, I'm trying not to fall back on things I've said 1,000 times. I try to talk to individuals. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I'm tired and I'm not up to it, and it's just easier to let experience speak for me. But you always find, always hit, especially at conventions, by things you simply couldn't have expected. Whether it's people who will tell you that your work was the only safe place they had in a lifetime of childhood abuse. Or the ones who can't even approach you. You just stand there trembling on the edge of tears, and of course you have to go around and give them a hug and tell them it's all right. I never, never believed for a long time that my work had that effect on people. Now I accept it, but I can't ever take it for granted. And it keeps coming in very strange ways. The classic example Connor and I both remember is of the two guys who I always say looked like the leg breakers that Big Julie from Red Hook sends over when you're falling a little behind on the vigorish, who saw my sign caught the name and came over to me, you know, it's such rapidity and such vigor that I kept thinking, who do I owe what? And it turned out that they literally grabbed my arm and said, your work saved our lives. We are sane, functioning adults today because when our parents got into one of their ferocious divorce battles where furniture and crockery gets broken and the police get called at some point, you know, we could run into the living room and close the door and put on the film of The Last Unicorn and just escape into that for a while. We have families of our own now, and we're actually sane. What the hell do you say to that?
There's not much there.
Possibly say.
Yeah, there aren't many words to it.
There weren't.
That would, words seem superfluous at that point.
And that's happened enough that, on the one hand, as I said, I don't take it for granted. But on the other hand, it's a responsibility in a sense. You have to be very careful not to say anything that if you like, that supports their vision of themselves, which usually isn't very good. You have to encourage them one way or another, even if they'll never be writers, or even if they'll only be, you know, internet writers or doing fan fiction. Even so, it's terribly important to remind them that there was a time when that was my only escape into my parents' living room, which was wall-to-wall books. I used to say that I was weird on the street, and I knew it, though the words nerd and geek weren't particularly around at the time. A geek was somebody who bit chickens' heads off in a carnival. That was what the word meant. But I knew I was, in my family I belonged, which so many of them don't feel. I knew I was safe in my parents' living room among those books, none of which were forbidden to me. So I'm very conscious of the people I'm talking to, and hate to use the phrase, but I have some notion of where many of them are coming from.
And it's good to never take your readers for granted, or time for that matter. Time's definitely not something to take for granted.
No,
and I want to thank you for your time with us today. And I want to thank you for devoting this time and giving us this interview. And I hope you guys enjoy your time at the convention. And I'm looking forward to the merchandise and stuff next year, and to what your plans are for the future. Which, we're out of time right now, so I won't ask you about that yet. People just have to check up on...
People can find him. He's got a Facebook page, Peter S. Beagle. There's also a main Last Unicorn fan page on Facebook where we post all this information. He does a wonderful newsletter called The Raven. It's lots of fun, and people can sign up and get it directly through the Conlon Press website.
I already do.
And so... If you already love Peter's work, come and find us. If you think you might love Peter's work, well, give it a try.
There's more coming.
Oh, definitely.
Quite a lot.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for your time today. My name is Philip Wesley. I've been your host this evening, and I'm here with...
Peter S. Beagle.
And Connor Cochran.
And good night.
And that's how the interview went down. To be honest, I feel that about 39 minutes was way too short for the interview, but, well, if it were up to me, that interview would be about 2 hours long. But, yeah, sometimes I come out of an interview feeling that, wow, I just have so many more questions. That's why there's always next year, or always the next episodes or so of Radio DMG. So, I'm going to go ahead and close out this episode with a song by a passenger, actually. Instead of our normal music, I'm going to go ahead and put in a song by this group called Passenger. I'm not really going to name the song because I found the song and I thought it was kind of interesting because of Well, you'll just have to listen to it. So, just signing out for this episode of Radio DMG. My name is Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and good night.
Well, we'll kiss, for that's how it begins. We'll embrace just to warm our skins. I'll think of her and you'll think of him. And we'll talk to keep the silence from our ears. And we'll laugh because we're so close to tears. We're just lonely, you know, that's why we're here. Cause you don't taste like you should, and you don't fit in my arms like she would. Lying in the dark, it's understood that we are both lost. We'll wake up with each other in our pores. You cover over white bits like I've not seen them before. We'll say goodbye and then we'll say no more. Cause hearts won by love and nor will they sell. And there is no love in this hotel. Though we're walking home, we know too well that we are both lost. We are both lost. And we won't be found. She was my comfort. He was your man. We come too far to be turning back. And we'll sit on our single beds, nothing on our hearts and tears on our threads. For we know the last unicorn is dead.
Okay, today we are interviewing an empty chair, and this empty chair has been a chair here at Akon, or rather at this hotel, for quite some time, haven't you, chair?
Yes. Yes, I have.
That's very interesting. And why on earth would anybody want to put that there? This has been your host, Philip Wesley. I'm talking with a chair. And good night.